With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
What's going on? Welcome to Knife Talk, podcast for knife makers, knife enthusiasts, DIYers. You're just trying to, you know, you're just trying to take some time out of your life. You need something to listen to. Why not listen to us? I'm Jeff Fader from Fader Knives. With me is Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives and Mareko Momasi, Momasi Fire Arts. We're here every Monday slinging some nonsense, maybe some not nonsense, and here we are. Guys, what's going on?
Sweating my nuts off.
You said that last week. Yes.
I know. It's got hotter and hotter and hotter. Yeah, it's 103 today.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yo.
It's and in the studio it is 103 as well. It really is. It's like
yikes.
But it's all good. The only worst thing that could happen is if my wife were to leave the country and leave me with the kids in the sweltering heat for 4 days, isn't it? Can you imagine that happening?
Oh, that would be horrible.
Worst case scenario.
That would be horrible, wouldn't it? But guess what happens tomorrow? Oh, God.
You got all three of them, huh?
All three of them in this heat, yeah. No aircon. So, yeah, we'll struggle through. Don't worry.
Hmm. Well, what are your plans? I mean, how are you going to... I remember when Lila was very young, I had to make plans because I just didn't want there to be any, like, well, what do we do now? Do you have, like, a game plan for all three of them, or...?
Yeah, sort of. So, a pool in the garden, just as much in the shade as possible. And, yeah, ice lollies, plenty of ice lollies. That's all we can do.
Popsicles, and if you're in the United States, I like ice lolly is definitely a better word for
ice lolly.
So that's it. It's gonna be the pool and fucking ice lollies.
Pool and ice lollies, and maybe the spoon for me and Buddy. Who knows?
The old spoon to the gooch. Teach him about his gooch with the spoon. Here you go. Here you go. Now this is a good segue into parenting. What will traumatize your kid or give them some sort of weird sexual proclivity later in life?
Spoon on the gooch.
Yeah. All of a sudden, he's going to have this weird thing about, you know, like, I don't want to say anything terrible about that sweet little boy, but just be careful. Any weird thing you do turns into strange trauma. Sexual proclivities later.
And trauma, yeah. And just to be clear, if you've never heard this show before...
This is a knife-making podcast.
This is a knife-making podcast. But we had a tip in the past, I think it was from an Australian, saying when it's too hot in the shop, we were talking about ways to cool down while it's working. And he had a cold spoon on the gooch. Is apparently very good.
Yeah, so you get a cold, like a soup spoon, and then you put it in the freezer... And then you put
soup
zinc
spoon.
On it.
Listen to you. A little teaspoon for you.
A little fucking ladle. A big ass soup ladle. Fill it up with your favorite zinc. And then just dip them.
Dip them. Yeah.
So.
Dip them and cool them.
Frankly, I'll take all the jokes I can get today. I need as much positivity as I could take. So
I was going to say, tell us about your whirlwind trip to California.
I want to hear about Mareko's birthday. Happy birthday, Mareko. I want to hear about what you did on your birthday.
So I was up at my sister's. I think last we spoke, I was in Florida and had a great time with Steve and finished that trip out really well. And then I got back to Seattle. I flew back into Seattle. My wife swooped me up and we drove a couple hours north to where my sister's staying during the summertime in Bellingham, Washington, which happens to also be where Bob Kramer is located. But we stayed at their, they stay at a lavender farm. It's like a 5-acre farm, lavender, and there's a creek running through the back. There's all kinds of like old farm equipment and a big field next to it and stuff. And so we just hung out there for the most part. We went to a market on Saturday and then on Sunday, what did we do? We did quote unquote birthday stuff because my birthday was on the on Monday, when the last episode aired, and it was good. My they surprised me. My sister and her partner surprised me with a big old tomahawk steak.
Whoa!
And it was a beast. It was probably like 2 inches thick. It was a big old fat cut.
Wow!
And she made. I've been seeing on Instagram all these like sushi bakes, where it's like futakake rice and like some sort of like spiced mayo or seasoned mayo and salmon and other stuff on top, maguro and scallions and all this other shit. But I saw one that was built put together in a bundt cake. The other ones are usually in like a baking dish. This one was put into a bundt cake and then served like a cake. And I jokingly sent it to my sister like 2 months ago. I said, this is all I want for my birthday.
Oh, listen.
And then she comes walking out of the kitchen with the fucking bundt cake, sushi bundt cake.
Showed up.
Yeah, she killed it. It was so good.
Craig, do you know what a bundt is?
I don't. No, no. A bundt cake.
I don't know how to describe a bundt. It's just a cake form. It's a pan with a odd form. It's like usually a ring shape.
Imagine a cake that has like a hole in the middle.
Yes, yeah, like a German thing. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So.
One of them. Okay.
I figured you knew all about a bundt.
No, I don't know nothing about a bundt.
Do you also know what the... All right, kids, close your ears. You know what the slang for what a bundt is?
No, please tell.
It's also referred to as the fupa. It's the upper fat belly area. But a bundt is, obviously, so...
You got the acronym wrong. It's FUPA, fat... upper pussy area.
Yep. You could do FUBA. Fat FUBA. Upper belly area, but
okay.
A bundt is also a belly.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I've never heard
Never mind. Don't worry
I
about
know
it.
What you mean. Okay. Okay.
All right. Yeah. It didn't go very well. So it was good. The food was good.
Yeah, food was good. That's all I try to ask for these days as I get older, is to spend my time with people I care about and eat some good food.
There you go.
And we accomplished that. We even went bowling. I haven't done a bowling birthday since I was 25, I think. Maybe when I turned 27. Anyways, went bowling for my birthday too with those guys. It was fun. And it was just super low key. And then I got back on Monday and picked up some knives on the way back. On my birthday, we drove down from Bellingham. It's like a 3-hour drive. Hit up the kitchen store where I do sharpening out of and picked up knives and went to the house and did all, kind of chilled that day. Didn't, like, literally did nothing that night. No special cake, no special meal, no nothing.
Any good drinky poos?
No.
No drinky poos?
I had been doing my drinking over the weekend as a celebration for my birthday when I was up visiting my sister. Mm-hmm. And a bit of wine intake for sure as well when I was at Steve's. But Tuesday, a fun, nice surprise when I got into the shop was some of the steel I brought back. I think I told you guys I was working on a chain pattern,
yes,
which is used for making in Belgium. There are these companies that were making all these different Damascus patterns. They were usually twist patterns of some sort and then making Damascus gun barrels out of them. And one of them was this pattern called the chainette pattern. And recently, Salem Straubus attempted this pattern. Steve Culver, who is a master smith based out of, I believe, Kansas City, has made an attempt at it. There's another maker out of South America named Manuel. I can't remember his last name. Sorry, Manuel. But all of them are just a little bit off. And so when I went down to work with Steve, I was like, it would be really cool if we could nail this. I think I figured out what the problem is, because all those other three makers, their patterns look very, very similar, but it's all the same kind of variance from what the original looks like. And so I was trying to identify what might be the difference in the preparation and forging process that makes the difference from the originals to what these guys have done. And I think I figured it out. So on Tuesday, I cleaned up the steel, did some etching, took a look at the materials, and we nailed it. And so I'm really excited now to move forward with this billet and get it constructed, hopefully get it welded back together nicely, and make a knife out of it. So
nice.
That's what we're with that.
And yeah. Steve's good? Steve's feeling good?
Yeah, Steve's doing good. In fact, everybody, Steve just started his own Patreon. When he was, he filmed a Forge series with Jason Knight a while back. It's an 8-episode thing. Jason recently gave Steve access to those videos, and so Steve now has a Patreon where you can pay, I think it's like $25 a month to have access to these videos. So Steve is a pioneer in our trade, and especially when it comes to the Damascus making. He's an OG, he's a great guy, and so I'm sure he would love any and all support that people would like to give him. He's been doing some really cool stuff for since the 70s. I think technically he's the first ABS mastersmith, though from on the books when they started actually keeping the books in 1983, he's maybe like one of the first five. But he got his ABS mastersmith certification in 81. He was literally the first ABS mastersmith. So
wow,
it was weird that for some reason they didn't start keeping books until 2 years later. But anyways.
Can't get nicer than Steve Schwarzer.
Steve Schwarzer is a great guy. Yeah. So that's what my birthday's been. Oh, and thank you. A few people reached out with some kind wishes for birthday action. And I think Jessie Huertas, iJessup on Instagram, her birthday was on the 20th of August, on the day before mine. And so happy birthday to her. Belated, I guess.
Birthdays.
Yep.
Jeff, so you went on a flight and to California, and tell me about, you were talking about taking your kid to school.
How was it? It sucked. I mean, it was fine. I shouldn't have started out with. We dropped our daughter off. My daughter is a merit scholar at this really, really, really nice liberal arts school in Southern California, and it's been her dream to go there. She got in with like a pile of merit scholarships, which was really, really cool. Made it very much more approachable for us to even attempt to go there. It was the big day. So we flew out. Of course, we were told that a hurricane was coming to, like a 1-in-70-year hurricane called Hurricane Hillary, which is hilarious because it's my wife's name. Hurricane Hillary. And she got her dopey friends broke her balls, and she's just like, I want to block all of them. I'm like, go ahead, block them all. Well, the Hurricane Hillary joke would fly out there, and let me tell you something about the West Coast, what they call a hurricane. I was some rain. That was it.
some light drizzle.
I mean, listen, if you're in the desert and you're not used to it and you get the mudslides, I'm with you 100%. But Los Angeles, bro, any flooding was completely a result of the terrible infrastructure in Los Angeles. I mean, you know, I think if you spit on the street, the gutters start to overflow. It was pathetic. I mean, literally, when I look out my window in our little town and it's raining hard, you see sheets of water. You see sheets of water coming down, and you look at the road. The road is slick with, you know, almost like a mirror of water. I know what rain looks like. This hurricane was like everyone's freaking out, panicking. People were rioting through this, you know, the supermarkets, getting all their bread and milk and all that nonsense.
Toilet
and
paper.
We walked through it, and we're just like, it doesn't really seem that bad. I mean, I'm sure it was bad in some places, and I felt terrible. And then all of a sudden, a hurricane, earthquake happens, and we made it through. Everyone was texting us, sending us nice messages, and I was, you know, saying, we're okay, everything's okay, we're going to be fine. And then one of the days, we made it, and then we walked to the campus before they were open, the day before we were supposed to move in, just to get a look. And we did a long, you know, a 2-mile hike to get there, and it was nice. Oh, wow. It was beautiful. And then moving day, the clouds dissipated, the sun came out, and everything was very green from this incredible rain. And then the jasmine trees outside of a room, and the goddamn banana trees, and the pineapple, and the goddamn coconuts, and the palm trees. I mean, this is like fucking paradise. And I was just like, God damn, this campus is nice. And it was beautiful. And the kids are super cool. It was really cool to see the kids. And we met her roommate, and her roommate's super cool. Her father was an awesome guy. He was a photographer. He lived in Brooklyn, and he and I knew some people in common. Actually, his old apartment was right next to my old shop. And, you know, we reminisced. He was there during 9/11. So we kind of like reminisced about being New Yorkers in 9/11. And it was like, we had a couple beers. And it was like, yeah, I feel comfortable. The kid was really nice, and she and a Lila got along very well. And
nice.
Yeah, it was That's really great. Cool. And then, you know, it's co-ed dorms. I mean, it's co-ed halls, which was crazy. But at the same time, it was, if I said something so funny to my kid. So they have all gender bathrooms. So it's not like one bathroom. It's like the whole, I mean, you got like all gender bathrooms. They make them so all the stalls are, you know, you don't have like a foot where you see people's feet if they're having a shit. You know what I'm saying? Right. It's like, it's all the way it's like a half an inch. So the shower stalls, the bathroom stalls, and they have the whole, this thing. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. And this is great. Cause you know, the kids are all, you know, everyone's really super nice. And I turned to my kid and I was like, you get to shit with the guys. I said, are you excited? You get to shit with the guys. And she just looks at me just like, oh, Jesus Christ, Dad, when are you going to leave?
Is that all you're thinking about?
Dad, I was like, wow, this is like your big opportunity. You can shit next to the big boys. And it was I got that joke out like 4 or 5 times. It was really funny. And but the really cool thing is, and I'm going to say this, I'll say, if you listen to last week's episode of the Full Blast podcast, I'm going to go into it in more detail. But the really cool thing was that the president spoke to all the kids, and the kids were nervous. There was a lot of kids, and they were talking about expectations, and they were talking about, you know, it's going to be hard. But the cool thing was, and I think that a lot of colleges are now starting to say this, is that it's okay to be offended by things. You can listen to something that you disagree with, but it doesn't mean you have to stop them. Doesn't mean one person's right and one person's wrong. It was just about like critical thinking is very important in our society. And
for sure,
being able to listen to other people's opinions is very important, especially in the collegiate setting. There have been like years and years of like, the guy don't like him, you cancel. This concept of canceling. Schools are really trying to say, this is not the way we, you know, interact as people. You can disagree with someone and that's okay. And then you kind of talk it through and see some mutual respect. That was really, really cool. And I'll say the coolest thing is we were supposed to stay until our flight was on Tuesday morning. And we were supposed to say we're going to have a drink with a coffee in the morning with Lila. So the night before we were about to go to dinner, and I said to Hillary, like, we're not coming to next tomorrow morning for coffee with Lila. We're getting out of here. Like, you got to rip the bandaid off. So we're sitting down for dinner, and I see, you know, there are a lot of these kids hanging out. There's not really kids with their parents. You know, we were hanging out having dinner, and I just turned to Hillary, and I'm like, are you done? And she says, yeah. I said, I'll take her tray. I took her tray and put her trays back. I said, okay, Lila, we're leaving. Lila's, what? I'm like, listen, they're all
You're
these
on your
kids.
Own kid.
You gotta meet with these kids. They're friends to be had, not hanging out with us. You spent 18 years with us. We're here. Don't worry. But I mean, now's the time. So we walked to the exit, and it was here. Hillary was teary, and Lila was teary, and we were walking. We walked to the gate. The gate was beautiful, overlooking the hills of Southern California. And this car drives by, and it's the dean of students who had this amazing speech about how hard it can be, but we believe in you, and you're meant to be here, and we don't pick just anybody, and you're supposed to be there. They're really trying to tell these kids don't feel. Imposter syndrome. And the dean pulls up, and I said, hey, Dean, this is my problem. When I hear a good speech, I let him know. I say, hey, Dean, great speech. You're the man. And he looks and he gives me a thank you so much. And then he turns to Lila in from the car. He points to her and he goes, are you ready? I have goosebumps on my fucking arms now just from men. And she's just got this big smile, tears running down her face. He goes, are you ready? And we're like, she's ready. And I said, no, let's get the fuck out of here. And so she went back to her dorm, and, you know, she's been there for, it's only been 24 hours. But, you know, that's it. And, wow. And we're excited. We're happy. We're Hillary and I are a little bit sad. We're you know.
Yeah. It's a big step, isn't it?
Oh, you know? Huge. Huge. You know, the crazy thing is when you have a kid, and a lot of our listeners have new babies, and you guys have young kids, and you remember the beginning of being needed. You're being needed for such little tiny things. And then all of a sudden, I was talking to my wife, and if you listen to Full Blast, I'm going to tell you, I had a problem on the plane, but we can leave it for that. You've heard enough. I was talking a lot, Hillary, and I was just saying, do you feel, and don't take this the wrong way, Hill, do you feel a sense of a release of not having to take care of someone? And she goes, you know, I do. I don't have to worry about where she's got to be or what she's got to do or the paperwork or anything like that. She's like, it is kind of like there's this, gap that's opened up. So it's just very kind of, we're kind of, it's all still fresh too. So we're all,
you've got to be
incredibly
proud, because a job as a parent is to prepare your children to be self-sufficient, you know, and this is that point now. You know,
she's cool, man. So. She, you know, I broke her balls this morning. She said to me, Lila was also very jet lagged, and I'm going to jet lag now. And Lila says, this morning, she sends me a message. She says, you know, I went to the food hall to get some breakfast, and they don't have any breakfast sandwiches. There are no BECs in this joint, no bacon, egg, and cheese. I said, knucklehead, I told you to move to New York. I said, you've gone to NYU, you get a BECs every 5 minutes. I said, you're in California, forget it. I'm like, I said, you can't.
It's granola time.
I called her, I said, you knucklehead, I told you. So this isn't fucking New York. And then she wrote back and she says, don't worry, Dad, I'll make my own. That was cool. The whole thing was cool. So
yeah, nice. So what have you got planned for the first weekend then?
Well, Hillary and I are dead. We're exhausted. And unfortunately, we were planning for our 50th birthday is like a month apart. And we were planning on going somewhere. And it's just we've come to the conclusion it's just too expensive. So we're not going to do any birthday shit. And, you know, and then Hillary is going to go to a parents' weekend and I'm not, because it's just too expensive for both of us to fly and board the dogs and get the hotel and let Hillary go. She's excited. She's glad. She's going to go in October and I'll get Lila in for Thanksgiving. And then what's our big thing? I think we're going to, I don't know, we're pretty jet lagged. So Hillary's made some plans with some friends, which is I'm really, really happy about. We're both being very conscious of each. We're both being very gentle with each other, which is pretty nice. And, you know, we're frankly, we're fucking high-fiving each other. We did a good job, you know?
You did a good job, exactly.
So it's no, there's literally that's fucking... We also, I mean, and I know this is knife talk and not fucking life talk, but we broke a lot of cycles. We broke a lot of cycles of shitty parenting. Most of the shitty parenting was on my father's side. My mother and my father were less than good parents. And I love my mother. I'm still taking care of her, trust me. But at the same time, in terms of the lacking of preparation of a kid, they both didn't do a very good job. My father was a prick. So we were both talking about the fact that we're grateful that the traumas that we suffered as children are not being passed to our child. So she's super confident. I've never talked down to her, never played mental games with her. I never passed aggressive. I never did anything other than to try to prepare her for life. And she's very confident. So we're doing a victory lap.
Nice.
Good.
But I'll be crying later, so you never know. At the end of this fucking thing, I might cry.
When the jet lag wears off.
It wears off, and you know. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Okay, let's talk about knives. Let's change the subject before you break down on us all.
My little girl. That's fine.
Questions. We got some. So if you've got questions, knife-related questions, send them our way. We are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, and we'll add them to the list. We've got a bunch, and we're going to try and crack through as many as we can today, with the first one being from Uncle Sam Metalworks. Hey, cuties. Oh, right. This is not a knife-making question, he says, but is blacksmithing. I'm primarily a knife maker. I recently just bought a house, and I had to put a deck on. I was thinking about doing some scroll work or
balusters. Like it's like a newel post or the posts or it could be a picket
with a basket twist in them, which I think I know what they are. Any suggestions before I start this project, and what diameter material should I use or not use? If this is something you don't want to answer on Knife Talk, I totally understand. Bye for now. I can hear Craig's voice saying this, he said. Well, come back to the future, and you definitely will hear my voice saying this. So what do you think? Jeff, you've done a fair few fences in your time.
Well, here's the key to a basket twist, and you can do them without having to carve them. You know, usually what happens is you get a post, like maybe, you know, depending on the size of the post, and then you would incise all four sides, and then you would the chisels would meet, and then you'd have four in between, you know, four, and what you do is you twist them. What you can also do is you can, as long as, if you have inch by inch posts, and then you had, half by half by half, four pieces of half by half, and then you kind of weld them all together so they're in between the two inch by inch posts, So it would be the same size. To make a basket twist, all you're doing is you're twisting it. You're heating up the basket part. You're twisting it, and then you're twisting it back on itself, and then it opens up and it makes that basket. So as long as, and it really could work with anything, you just want to give it a couple tries before you do it. I personally would, especially for an outdoor railing, I wouldn't try to incise it because you're going to have a lot of jagged edges that you can't clean up. The move would be is you get some like round bar, and then as long as the outer sizes of the round bar is the same size as the post itself, you should be able to weld them up, clean them up, and then twist the round bars, and then when you twist it back, it'll make that basket. That's the standard idea of how basket twists are made. It's a lot of fucking, be honest with you, the juice ain't worth the squeeze of those fucking things. It's like for wizards and shit. Go ahead, give it hell. I think there are probably some YouTube videos on it. I know that Jesse made some. I made a couple before and not too excited about it. But all it really is twisting it one direction. It's actually just like the pineapple twist where you twist it, you know, a certain amount of times and then you twist it back half the way. So it's like, you know, a couple rotations one way and then let it cool, heat it up again, and then twist it back on itself half that and you'll end up with something close.
Gotcha.
There you go. Okay. I don't know if I made a lot of sense, but
that sounds like gibberish to me. I can't even visualize what you're talking about.
Well, you know,
all I heard was that there's a YouTube video on it.
There's, I mean, it's like the basket's in the middle of your post, so you have to like you have to capture the inside, so you can fake it by like welding bars to make that. When you weld a square, you know, you have four bars together, you weld them all together to the same dimension as the maiden bars, and then you twist it.
Oh, I see. So they're like at the end of the solid square.
They're in the middle.
1-inch square.
They're in the middle.
Oh, they're in the middle. Okay.
So you take a piece of, we're going to do fucking basket talk.
This episode of Basket Talk
is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturer of the finest treat ovens available. If you want to heat treat some baskets, you get yourself a basket, go get to evenheat-kiln.com and check out what they got. Get that top control, get that solid state drive, solid state relay, get yourself that even heat.
I get it now. So it's 1-inch square solid stock.
Right.
And then the half inch by half inch square stock, four pieces are tacked straight in line on the end.
In the middle.
Between two solid stock.
You're the man.
Then you twist them and then you reverse twist them to open. I've seen that. Okay.
Dude,
that makes a lot more sense.
You fucking cleared it up. I would do round just because it'll be, especially for outdoors, it'll be easier to kind of clean up and keep, you know, not from rusting. All those little squares tend to get a little bit, you know, trickier to kind of keep clean outside. But yeah, you figured it. That's it. So,
okay.
Craig,
I was struggling for a second.
I'm sorry. You know, I started to realize I don't think I did a very good job, but you cleaned me up, so I appreciate it.
I don't know about that.
You got it. Who's going to take Randy Richard?
I'll take him. Take him out back.
I bet you would.
Take him out back.
How'd you feel if you saw someone you sold a $700 or $800 knife to go on a classified forum and try to resell that same knife for $100? I just wish that that guys who wanted to resell a custom knife would be more respectful to the original maker's time and effort and sell it for closer to what it's actually worth. It's not like we're making cheap garage sale items. That was a bit of an exaggeration. But yeah, I've seen guys grossly underselling knives to make a quick sale. It seems to cause some new potential customers to hold out, thinking if they just wait it out, they might pick up one for dirt cheap somewhere else rather than having to pay full price with the actual maker. What do you guys think about the basically, he's talking about secondary market, somebody underselling a knife that they normally would sell for a bit more.
I mean, you can't control what people do.
No.
When they own something, and I'll tell you a quick story. I was going to wait a while because it happened a while ago. Somebody sent me a message, one of the original guys who got a Cuban knife when I did it with Carl Ruiz, and he says, I'm, you know, getting rid of some things. I need to make some money. How do you feel if I sell the Cuban knife? I'm like, it's your knife. Do whatever you want with it. He put it up online on eBay or something like that for like so much more than it was worth.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, I think he expected me to try to sell it for him, but it was like, he was selling, trying to sell it for like $2,500, just like way too much money, way too much money. And I think that there was this expectation that I was going to help him sell it. And when I saw the price on it, because sometimes people say, if you ever see another Cuban, let me know. I'm like, I'm not fucking helping this guy. No offense. I'm with you. Do your thing. But at the same time, it's like, you're on your own. You're on your own. You know, I'm not going to like, if this was like, I try to get a kidney and, you know, I just want to get what I paid for it, I'll help you out. But like, you want to like four times it, you know, I'm not doing that. I'm not helping you with that. Sure. And then it sat there for a while. And then somebody sent me a message like, the price is going down. And that made me feel even worse. Like, no one
exactly.
That made me feel worse and worse and worse. And it went for, I don't know what it went for. It went for more than he paid for it, which I'm glad. Congratulations. Yeah. But it was like, he was trying to gouge people. And then I think the reason why I didn't like it is because he made up a lot of terminology that wasn't true.
Oh, cool.
Forged knife and this is like a lot of shit that I had to write. And then the size, he wrote the size was different than it actually was. And he, all the information was wrong. And the only thing I wrote to him was, you got to get this part right because they're going to come to me. So I gave him the right information and I just left it alone. And I just was like, God bless you.
Yeah.
My brother.
I think you're right. Once you've sold it, it's not your property. But it would sting a bit seeing something selling really, really cheaply. It would sting a bit. But it's, you don't know the circumstances of the person selling it, how badly they need that money. It's none of your business. Right. Weirdly, you've sold it on. It's none of your business.
That's how you want to get irritated. Go on eBay and look up Montana Knife Company.
you're
irritated. A lot of them are underpriced what they normally get. And a lot of them are like Josh Smith knife. And they just the way people describe these things.
Oh, interesting.
It's just like, I don't fucking like the way you wrote that. I was looking at one. I was like, I don't like the way you wrote that. And it was, everyone's trying to get a little bit of something. So there was one point where I was looking at, looking at Montana Knife Company on eBay. And I was just like getting irritated. I was irritated for Josh. I wasn't irritated by what was up there.
I would say buy that. If it's really $100, buy that fucking knife, clean that bitch up, and sell it yourself.
That's a pretty good idea. Right there. That's a pretty good idea right there.
No, it's always been interesting to me to, and I don't see the secondary market very often. I usually hear about it from either the person that ends up buying a knife or something like that down the road. But it is an interest, if you can somehow, I don't know how you would know where and how much these things are selling for, but if you're trying to kind of gauge the value of your work, it might be a way to see, like, if you're underpricing yourself, because if your stuff's in enough demand and people are selling it for 2-3 times as much, then maybe that says that you can bump up your prices a little bit. I've talked about this before, how I feel like I have this sense of ownership or responsibility to take care of this thing, even though it's not mine anymore. I have offered actually, let's see. But yeah, multiple times. I'm trying to think of how many people I've offered this to. But when I get wind of a knife getting ready to be sold, I'm like, send that thing to me. Let me clean it up. Because it's when that knife exchanges hands, all I can think about is like, maybe there's some weird, nasty, like that knife I just refurbished. If that person sold that knife the way it was, even though it doesn't actually reflect poorly on me, I would still feel like it does. And that's like my own mental issue around that. Like struggling, like I feel like that's my fault. And I want to clean it up. But when I hear about knives coming for sale or somebody bought or just recently acquired a knife of mine from somebody else, I'm like, fuck, why didn't they tell me? But I have helped actually people sell my work. Because I do have a backlog. I have an email list. I have people who are ready and interested to buy some of my work, and even if it's older work, and especially if I'm refurbished it. Like, once you've refurbished it and cleaned it up and put a new etch on it, and maybe I update the grind from a convex to an S grind, and I make some minor adjustments in the handles sculpting and stuff like that, that's basically a brand new fucking knife at that point. I did that for a guy, and what was cool is he was just trying to get the money out of it that he put into it. He was in a tight spot, and I feel bad for him for that he had to sell it. But I cleaned it up, and he helped him find a buyer, and he kicked me back a nice tip of like $500.
Nice.
And so I wasn't mad about that, and it helped. You know, it did take some time to do all that work to like re-etch it and re-grind it and redo the handle and all that shit. But it wasn't like building the thing brand new. It was just kind of like clean a spa day. And so I think if you can offer that potentially for people, then that might help prevent some of the issues that people might experience on this with the whole secondary market thing. Some people are afraid, though, customers and for or whatever are afraid to basically say either like I'm on hard times with money, or I didn't really enjoy the knife, so I'm going to sell the knife. I think they're afraid to hurt the maker's feelings or whatever. And in my case, personally, I'm like, I don't give a shit why you want to get rid of it, but let me clean it up first. And I can even possibly help you find a buyer, if not help you make a little bit money on the sale.
Look at you.
And possibly doing yourself out of another bigger sale, really.
Yeah.
Because if these are people waiting to buy one of your knives,
exactly,
you're taking one off your list, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
There you go.
You're a good man, Mareko.
No ad reads, or?
Well, but I was trying to think, how can I shoehorn a read in? I was going to say, well, Mareko, if you were going to clean up a knife,
there you go.
Which grinder would you use for that?
I 100% use my Broadbeck to clean up that knife. It was perfect for the job. What I love about the Broadbeck is that it is designed not only to fit all the different tooling arms that they have, but they can do cross-platform, so they can accept tooling arms from other machines to use in the Broadbeck. They're great guys. They're knife makers making grinders for knife makers. And if you go to the website, broadbeckironworks.com, and whatever you get, whether it's one of their knife packages or tool arms or the sewing machine or surface grinder, whatever it is, make sure with checkout, type in Knife Talk 10 to save yourself 10% on your order. Again, go to broadbeckironworks.com, type in Knife Talk 10 at checkout, and you will save yourself a little bit of cash, and you'll get the job done for sure.
There we go. Okay. Ebon Blade Customs said, with Craig mentioning he considers himself a hobbyist now, it makes me curious where hobbyists sit in the community. I'd like to think we are a silent majority, but every forum or Discord or Reddit post seems to be either veteran knife makers with $1,000 knives or armchair professionals who've made Forged in Fire their personality but would never think to make a knife.
Good question.
Yeah, and from you know, I used to spend a lot of time in these forums and on Discord and Reddit and stuff like that. When I started making stuff, and I'll be honest with you, there's not much value to be found in any of them. It is a bunch of, as you say, armchair professionals or people trying to belittle other people and that kind of thing. I don't think there's much of a community in most of those forums, to be honest with you. People are out to make themselves feel good.
I was chatting with Honor Kagler, and we were talking because he's, you know, he gets people. He gets these people who tell him how he should be doing things. And usually it's like, I've been a welder for 25 years and the way you're doing this isn't right. And he just like, you know, lets him have it. And I was telling him that we're talking about the internet. We're talking about, the Facebook group in my town is under real problems right now because things were said and there may or may not have been bomb threats at this establishment, and it may be due to things they've said or been involved with. And it's just like, there's like questions. It's just like, basically what I ended up saying to, I said, can you imagine that you go so far on a forum to the point where there may be a knock on the door from the FBI? That happens. Wow. Like imagine because the conversations a lot of people have online are meaningless. You know, it's like you said, Craig, you're trying to one-up somebody, or you're trying to one-up somebody, or I got bad service, and then there's this back and forth, and there's this like strange evolution of like anger and all this stuff. And then if it turns into something real, can you imagine something as useless and meaningless as a disagreement online turns into a knock on the door from the FBI. Hmm. What a waste. And I told him about it, and he said one of the greatest quotes I've ever heard. I'm going to use my newsletter next week. Only humans, this is straight out of his fucking mouth, only humans could have something so powerful like the internet where you can learn so much and use it for dumb shit. That was like this beautiful, you know, that little fucking wacko Hunter Kaglar is like the has this beautiful mind for just breaking it down to the simplicity. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
So yeah. Hobbyists are great. I mean, it doesn't matter. It matters when people are aggressive towards each other over nothing, you know, over something stupid. That's, you know.
And I'd say, I mean, he says it here in the post that the silent majority are probably hobbyists. And of course they are. You know, everybody who starts as a hobbyist, not many people go straight in to say, okay, well, now I'm a full-time knife maker and this is provided for my family. It doesn't work that way. So everybody starts that way. And we know so many amazing knife makers. It's still just a hobby to them. You know,
right.
It's not their main business.
Right.
I don't think it's to be looked down on in any
100%.
Way at all.
No. There's master bladesmiths realized that it's way more beneficial for their families if they have a job and then they make knives on the side for playing money. No. Mike Quisenberry, I think he considers it a hobby that he loves.
Yeah.
Do you think the issue is the term hobbyist? Maybe it's more accurate to just refer to yourself as a part-time maker, because I feel like you can still be a professional but only do it part-time.
There are a lot of people who feel themselves professional, like fabricators and stuff and blacksmiths, who hate the term maker. They just like, when you say maker, it automatically sounds like, and this might be a hot take and you might disagree with me, but when you start using the word maker, when you fill out your tax forms, that ain't in there. You know, maker ain't in there. You know, it's almost like a different variation of artist, you know, or something. But like, I can see that there's this delineation between the value of what one calls themselves.
Yeah. A maker is almost like a crafter. It could be thought of that way, I think. You know, the handy with crafts.
I almost feel like you got to be a YouTuber to be a maker.
Possibly, yeah. Again, that's just a good example of how people see different words as, you know, different meanings. But it is a weird one. It is a weird one. But, you know, there's people who this isn't their main gig and they're incredible at what they do. That doesn't mean to say they're not thinking about it all the time. You know, they're very professional, but it's not their main gig.
And can we also just say that just because you're not a professional knife maker, that's not a demerit on who you are. Just because you're not a full-time maker or you're not, that's not a demerit. If you're enjoying what you're doing and you're having a good time and it gives you satisfaction in life, then you've won. But we have these like pecking orders in regards to what's more valuable than others. And it's like, in the grand scheme of things, if you're happy, who the fuck cares?
Yeah. I guess for me, when it comes to definition between a hobbyist and otherwise, somebody more professional, it's just like, I guess, the tax code here in Washington State, a hobbyist work, like a form of income, it's hobbyist if it's not your main source, like how you're getting paid. Or how you what you're using to pay your mortgage and your bills and health insurance and all that other shit. It's kind of just like maybe you make a little bit of money here and there on the side. So that's usually when it's hobby work. But if this is if that's your main source of income, then that goes from being a hobby to, I can't remember what the term is, but basically, yeah, your main source of income.
Yeah, professional. Yeah.
Kind of more on the professional end of this. And that's all I was trying to delineate between, like, maybe you're not a hobbyist. Maybe you're just a part-time bladesmith or knife maker. And you're still professional. You just, I don't know.
We say these words and they stick with some people in some strange way, and it's like, and people get offended or people feel like they're not as good, or I'm not as, you know, it's just like we use these goddamn terms too much. I have very good listener feedback, by the way. Anytime you want to go.
Okay. Okay, let's tell the guys about this thing first.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers. Available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15. Do it now!
Now.
Let's all just be nice to each other. With the part-time, the full-time, the maker, the bladesmith, the blacksmith, who gives a shit? Just the go out and enjoy your life. Because, I mean, you're going to be toes up in no time, guys. You're going to be like 6 feet under in no time. So
you sound like a man who just dropped his kid off to university. You've aged a hell of a lot.
You make fun of me. I'm fucking enlightened, dude. I am like the Dalai Lama over here, except I'm not sucking on people's tongues. That fucking guy. Hey, baby, let me suck on that tongue. Namaste. All right, listen, guys. He'll never get over that as far as I'm concerned. No. Dalai Lama, he ruined it. Sucking on one tongue, you're done. All right, guys, listen. If you go to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, you can interact with the show, send us the DMs, questions, and listener feedback. The first thing comes from our friend Holly Loftus, who says, could you please shout out the Cutlers Award for the UK listeners? The Cutlers Award is a grant of £2,500 to support one culinary knife maker to develop professionally through mentorship and skill building. It's open to anyone trading as a knife maker in the UK. The money can be used for mentorship, equipment, and courses. It's not the best knife contest. Applications are judged based on how well the £2,500 will be used to push someone's career forward. Go follow at, if you're on Instagram, at thecutlersaward.uk. So, Holly Loftus, nice. There you go. I'm with you.
Here we are.
Our friend. All right. All right. So here's the listener feedback. Ronald Knives. So last week somebody wrote, I think it was Ash Edwards, Celery Patch, whatchamacallit. He said, we're talking about American food. And I made a crack. I said, yeah. Australians making fun of Americans. You know, why don't I say, I thought you Australians all ate a Vegemite. So Ronald Knives. Who? P.S. Everyone sent in a tome. We got like Shakespeare Juniors out there. So
Jesus Christ.
Get ready, guys. All right. So Ronald Knives says, "Don't go criticizing Vegemite. Those who fail to appreciate it are simply too weak to appreciate its overwhelming power. Either that, or there are people from overseas who have been tricked into eating the wrong way by smart-ass Australians, mostly the latter. Also, kangaroo is very lean, very tasty, available in most supermarkets, and I'm not even joking." So, either one of you have Vegemite?
No.
Okay.
No. I'd be up for it.
I don't like Marmite either.
I'm under the impression you have to put the least amount possible on. And it's just like...
I'm not even quite sure what it is.
Oh, God. Yeasty. I swear to God, now here it comes. All the Australians are going to give us a fucking recipe for this bullshit. We know. It's, you don't know. Oh, let's do an Australian accent. How you do an Australian accent is you take the A sound and make an I sound. So if we were saying snake, you would say snike.
Snike. And you've got to come up as well at the end of each sort of sentence.
And you say, no worries a lot.
Is that a snike?
No worries a lot. No worries. I can't figure it out, but all right. It's some sort of malt shit. Congratulations to Australia. We're with you. Australia.
Do you know Marmite? Do Americans know Marmite?
Is there a big difference?
Yeah. It's very similar to Vegemite, but it's beefy. It's like a meat extract, yeasty kind of malty thing. I hate it, but people either love it or hate it. And now it's their big sort of advertising slogan. You either love it or you hate it. And
fucking weird. But,
you can use it in stocks and things like that and gravies and stuff because it gives it a real sort of beefy extra sort of zing.
Yeah, I was going to say it almost sounds like a beef, like bouillon almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, not quite. It's like a thicker, yeastier version. Yeah, it's a strange thing. I couldn't really compare it to anything else apart from Vegemite.
I'm trying to make some Marmite butt jokes, but
do you know? Okay, we'll just talk about foods. Do you know Twiglets? Do you have Twiglets over there?
No, I don't know what a Twiglet is.
Okay, well, let's move on.
Is that like a small branch?
Are they like Twix?
Is it Twiglet? Is that like
it's a Marmite flavored snack, basically?
It's not like next to the
going off track yet.
Not next to the old balls, right? The old
balls and Twiglet.
All right. All right, so God bless you, Ronald Knives. Don't tell me what Vegemite is. I'm not interested. I'm just kidding. All right, Paul Jansen says, dick joke after a glorious dick joke. Well done, guys. I had to pull over. I was laughing so hard. Also, on a side note, calling some liquid, you know, blank piss is pretty common. We were talking about gator piss. There's a lot of gator piss comments, by the way. Get ready, ladies and germs. Local metal fabricators call penetrating oil skunk piss and brake cleaner tiger piss. It doesn't change the quality or the end result. Here's Wilder Knives of Australia says, I don't understand why customers would even care to know about gator piss. Why do we have to even tell them at all? Just say etched or acid etched or whatever. We don't ever explain to our customers what brand of epoxy, super glue, or quench oil we use. So why should we tell them we use gator piss? Just my thoughts. Better disclose. Yeah. Oh, better disclose what you neutralize as well. Then you use that Arm & Hammer baking soda or that Kroger brand baking soda.
I think gator piss is a great name, marketing-wise. And I think if people knew they're using gator piss, they'd be like, wow, it's like extra mystery, it's extra magic involved.
Well, there's one, I'm going to read one more gator piss thing and we're going to talk about it because I'm actually interested in, I have a thing to going to go about. But Nate Walpole says, if folks think that gator piss is a bad name, don't get them welding and using cooter snot. Yes, someone named Tip Dip that name, cooter snot. So they use the tip. I told last week you dip your tip in the tip dip, and they call it cooter snot. But here's what I'm interested in, and I think a lot of it is perceptions. And I thought about it because I know that, you know, we've talked about this before, and, you know, Mareko says, you know, you don't have to call it gator piss, call it GP, whatever. And it was interesting because last week I said that these really high-level knife makers are just saying they don't like the name and stuff like that. And I wonder, and I said to, and I said, when I do their ad reads, I say, you don't have to tell your customers everything. And I'm wondering why this material, gator piss, is an awesome etching, and it's marketed towards makers. Marketed towards makers, and not marketed towards customers. Like, your customers aren't true makers. And a lot of makers are kind of squeamish about it because it's like, I feel, this is my opinion, and I wonder, I could be wrong, tell me if I'm wrong. If ultimately, subconsciously, makers are a little self-conscious of their prices because most of our knives, we can't afford ourselves. If you're a little bit self-conscious of our prices and you think if your customers who are willing to pay those prices knew that you were using something called gator piss, that maybe you weren't serious enough and maybe the value really is not correct based on your not seriousness about it.
Nah. I do think the opposite. I think it sounds magical.
It sounds magical?
Magical. You know, you've got this special alligator piss that you can only use this to dip this in. You know, it sounds...
Specially sourced from the bayous of Louisiana.
But I mean, we don't say it. I mean, I don't want to say it. I don't want to explain it because it almost belittles what they think I'm doing.
Yeah. I think it's genius branding.
And it is.
It reminds me, I do another podcast. Anyway. And in this podcast, I was doing a quiz with the other host. Yes, there's other hosts, ladies and gentlemen. And I was doing a quiz and he was messaging me. He said, oh, am I going to get fucked on this quiz? So my response was, yes, lube up. And I just looked for a generic sort of lube picture gif to send him. And so if you just put like... lube in Google Images, you see all these brands of lube, and there's one called Up Yours, right? And it's just like the best branding ever. And I've just sent you the picture, guys. You get if you so it's a fisting lube.
Oh my god! Oh my what the matter with you? Oh my god!
Can you see
you
that?
You are a horrible human being. What are we? What that depths have we now sunken into?
We've sunk into this is a bit of an in-joke because obviously you guys can't see, but if you Google image Up Yours lube, you'll see exactly what I'm talking
may
about.
May I say, you know who doesn't want this the most? The labeling company. The company that makes the labels.
They don't care. They're getting paid.
There's no liability
on their end.
It's like you got grandma who's running the inker. Put it more purple. Put it more purple, grandma. Why? We're getting the Up Yours. It's the fisting lube. We got to match the color of what goes up the guy's butt. Grandma keels over. What the fuck? However, speaking of lube, I'll tell you, we were walking
speaking of lube.
This is back to Southern California. We were walking down the street heading towards the college. Yeah. And there was a place where you get your car, your Jiffy Lube, you know, like a Jiffy Lube, which is where you get your oil changed in your car. You have a place where you can do a fast oil change. There's a place called Jiffy Lube. Well, this place was called Lube Master. And I, Hillary and I looked at it, and I looked at Lila and I said, these are your fucking people now. These are your people. They were I was just like, what the fuck town did you have us move you to? Fucking Lube Master? Are you nuts? So she took a picture of me pointing at the Lube Master sign. I thought, yeah, nice. Good. God bless them. But this, what you sent us, it's fucking horrible. It is so bad.
Available in all good Amazon stores.
Holy
now.
Christ. Yeah. It is really something. God damn it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell everybody about... There's no link here. But maybe Lawrence will start selling it. I don't know. He starts to sell everything that we talk about on the show. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. They sell steel, belts, handle materials, lube, tools, forges, kilns, and more. They sell it all. They're also the Canadian distributor for combat abrasives. So go take a look. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. Also Maritime Knife Supply on Instagram. But honestly, anything we mention on the show, Lawrence makes it his job to make sure he gets that thing in stock. So... if you're looking for Up Yours Lube, Lawrence, we got a challenge for you.
Oh, my God.
And then let's just finish this off by saying Santa Claus is your parents. And then now the emails will be immediately deflected. That erases everything you've said. Because they all really, the parents are just like, oh, my God, my kids think that Santa Claus is... They did a whole thing on Up Yours Lube that don't matter because I said Santa Claus is your parents. And I'm in trouble now. So you're welcome.
It's always Jeff in trouble.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I have a couple. We got to do a couple more listener feedbacks because this one turns into... This is actually a dilemma. Ash Edwards says, I've got a dilemma. I have a mate named Mark who had a 50th birthday, and I was doing knife making as a hobby at the time, and I told him when I'm a bit better making knives, I'll make him something. At the time, I bought him some fishing lures for his birthday, so I wasn't really, it wasn't like I didn't do anything. He acted like I had an outstanding invoice, and he demanded his knife. My birthday came around and went without nothing in return. So I figured, okay, that's that. I don't have to give him any. I don't owe him anything left. I don't owe him anything more.
Right.
6 years later, I now make knives in a much more serious way and charge accordingly. I've invested heavily in knife making and changed my entire life around it. My, quote, mate is a part of a men's shed. I don't know what that fucking thing is, but I don't like it. Maybe. Hey, Ash Edwards, we all know what you need to get him now. Craig will send you a link. Knife Talk 10 for all the Up Yours.
Up Yours.
Oh, my God. The med shed. This is perfect. All right. So my mate need that med shed. Let me get back to it. That was too fucking good. All right. So my mate's part of a men shed where I'm the supervisor every Wednesday night. This is so funny. Now all of a sudden all I can think of is fisting each other. Sorry. It's basically a community workshop where we make stuff and enjoy a meal together under the mental health banner. After following Mark's lead, all the other members of the men's shed are under the impression that I should give them a free knife too.
I've explained
knife making isn't a hobby and it's my income and it's how I pay my bills and put food on the table. And I told them if they want to support a small artisan business, they can check out my website and I'll give them a discount. Nope. They expect full custom-made knives for free. I've explained it would be like giving a small business giving away $10,000 if I gave them all a knife. They still ask for their knives weekly. I now say suck a dick whenever I get requested, and it's awkward. The thing that pissed me right off was one of them commented on my social media business post saying, nice knife, just wish the wait time wasn't over 5 years. I blocked the fucker, and I pride myself on good customer service, and he just implied otherwise. He fucked with my potential customers, not cool. And then he wrote something else, but all know what he needs to do.
Yeah, up yours.
Get yourself in that fucking fist dip. That fucking up yours. They got purple label and bring the men shed what they really want, because clearly that's what they want.
Mm. Yeah.
Jesus, have you ever been in that position where somebody's needling you for a free knife?
Family members, yeah, regularly, even now, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a friend that helped me with some building work in a shop, like putting up framing.
Yeah.
Just like sticks and nails. And for
it's just like your knife, he's just bits
yeah,
of
it's a no. He just moved a couple straws around. Okay, bring that knife.
Sticks and nails.
No, I mean like 2x4s. That's what they call it, sticks. Anyways, put up some walls, just this framing for the walls. And then he felt like he was owed a fucking knife. And at the time when we were first doing it, I was like, you know, what can we do to, like, he was just helping and it was a very simple thing. And, I was like, maybe I can make you a knife. And he's like, don't worry about it. We'll figure out something down the road or figure out something later. And then he was like 2-3 years later, he's like, so where's my knife? Are you going to make me a knife? And like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he's like, I built that thing for you. Aren't you going to make me a knife? I'm like, what are you? All of it. So we didn't even have a conversation. We went from, oh, maybe we'll figure something out. Whatever. I wish I had just paid him, because at this point he still bugs me about it. And it's like, if I made double-ended dildos, he would give a fuck. He would not care or have zero interest in getting one of those. But because it's a knife, he wants one.
And what's up with today's show?
So frustrating.
You guys, I mean, you know, I say just give him a, you know, make it. You know what we should do? I'll tell you what we should do. Somebody should make a 3D file for a nice die, like a casting. And then you send a casting of the fist dip to people. And then it looks in the shape of a knife, but it's really, it's like fist dip.
Nice. Yeah.
Well, that didn't go very well.
Not really, no.
I think a lot of times that people don't know how to joke. And I think that they break balls and they think that it's nonstop. The online thing is bothersome, and that happened to me, and I told it a couple months ago, where a guy was like, didn't really respond to we wanted an oyster knife, didn't respond to our emails, and then wrote something like, boy, you make all this stuff before you make mine. And it was like, we couldn't figure out what happened, and he never got the emails. And it was like, when you go online and you fuck with someone's business, it goes from being funny banter to being really, 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 really uncool. But the real issue is, Ash, and I'm sorry to say this, I'm really, really sorry to say this, they don't respect you. And that's the problem. That's what I think. And I find that to be angering to a certain degree, because they think that because they've seen you, you know, 5 years ago doing whatever you're doing, and now they think that they know you, that they still have the right to kind of fucking disrespect you. And I find that to be appalling. I don't like that at all.
I think what we do is quite niche. It clearly is, or niche, as you may call it. And for a lot of people, they don't understand that there's a knife world out there. When I tell people I do a podcast about knife making, they're like, what? Who listens to that? I say, I do admit most of the sad fuckers. But but what I'm saying is like, when you tell people you make knives, they don't understand that it's a business. And they just think you're just messing about in this case, in a shed.
Right.
They don't see it as a serious, serious business. So I think it's easy for them, people to say, well, just make me a knife. You know, it doesn't mean anything to you. It's just, well, it would, because it's, you're literally taking money out of my pocket.
It's incredibly disrespectful, I think. And, you know, you can give some up yours to them niche, that niche.
Yeah.
Will Redhead has to say, this is a good one. This is a really good one. Will Redhead says, I think it's Redhead or Reedhead. Will Reedhead, Will Redhead. Hey, fellas, I've been a keen listener for a while now, and like many others, I appreciate all the time you put the podcast in the knife-making community. I always thought my first message to you would be to talk about whether or not an S-grind will go deep enough to expose more of the twist of a twisted W's pattern, or discuss the pros and cons of fluxless welding. However, I find myself writing to talk about cock and balls.
This is the kind of content we're
I'm
here.
I'm telling you, man. My wife and I have given birth to our first children, identical twin girls. And so I'm home settling into our new life. My wife is Mexican, and her mom and dad have come over to the UK to support us during the first few weeks of our girls' arrival. Anyway, I'm currently painting a new room for the babies and listening to a lot of Knife Talk in particular. Catching up on a few missed episodes, the episode called A Cowboy to the Rescue came up, and I'm relishing in it. The keen wit and banter. That's when I had Ben Snor on filling in for you guys. I hear the front door open and up come the in-laws to say hello after their long journey over. I greet them warmly, and then they come into the new room that their beloved grandchildren will be resting their tiny heads.
Oh, boy.
Just can't prepare yourself. It is just at this point that Jeff and Ben Snor really get stuck into dick and balls that were being mowed into the lawn for the king's coronation. We were obsessed with how they mowed the dick and balls into the coronation, king's coronation. Now, this was funny as fuck, but my phone was at the top of the wardrobe at full volume, so it became the soundtrack to our in-laws' tour of the granddaughter's new room. And if anyone goes back to have a listen to that episode, you'll find just what you thought they had coming. When you had the topic covered enough, they kept coming back for more. So he just basically wrote that it was the whole thing was problematic. So
brilliant.
Brilliant. And then the last, and that's pretty much it. I mean, unless you want to go into more eczema talk. There's a lot of eczema talk questions.
Eczema.
Okay. Like a lot of people have been, a couple of weeks ago, somebody has eczema, and that their hands get really in bad shape from working in a shop. Eczema is like autoimmune deficiency or autoimmune disorder.
Yeah, well, you get,
And there's just a lot of barrier cream questions.
Up yours would work very well for any eczema sufferers, I think.
Perfect. Perfect way to end listener feedback. Get some up yours. Get some up yours. It's got a fist, a covered fist. You can't go wrong. Up yours, children. There you go.
Up yours. Okay, now's a good time to tell everybody about TexasFarrierSupply.com. Amazing people. And you know what they sell? They sell Indasa Rhino-Wet, which is the sandpaper of the superstars. It's what we all use. Saves you money, saves you time. So go take a look, TexasFarrierSupply.com, because they sell everything you could possibly need, whether you're a knife maker, a farrier, bladesmith, whatever you want to call yourself. They've got everything there. Great, great people. And if you use Knife Talk 10 at checkout, you'll also get 10% off your full order as well. So fill up that cart with your Rhino Wet. Take a look at everything else that they have, because you can get 10% off with Knife Talk 10 at checkout. Shall we go back to questions?
You got it.
Okay. Hulahan Forge. Hi, guys. Any tips on how to keep handles even on both sides when grinding the shape? Do you use jigs or fixtures, or do you measure it, or do you just eyeball it? Thanks. Keep up the good work. This is probably a good one for you, Mareko, because your handles are quite intricate.
I mean, they can be. Yeah, especially the Japanese cowboy handle. Or the faceted Western. I usually just have a mechanical pencil handy, and when I cut in a facet, let me back up. I'll start by cutting in the profile of the whole handle along the spine and down at the pommel of the handle and then across the belly. And then I basically don't touch that until the very end. And I use those flats on either the spine or the belly as ways to transfer lines from side to side. So say I'm cutting in a facet on the right side. Wherever that facet ends, I'll just take that mechanical pencil and I'll just sketch a line around whichever is closest, either around the belly or to the spine, or around the spine to the other side, and then use that as a reference for how far down, once I go to the other side, to push that facet. And I just use that back and forth. And it's a simple tool to have handy, and it's really effective, honestly. But otherwise, I don't really do a lot to especially when I'm doing like fully contoured handles. It's mostly just everything's by eye.
So you don't use a table or anything. It's all by hand and eye. You're not using a table set in an angle or anything like that at all.
I basically never use a tool rest or the table for anything ever.
Okay.
Not that there's it's perfectly useful. I've never used one. That's just been the way I've always worked. I will say, before I start sculpting, especially when I'm doing a hidden tang construction with an integral bolster, often the handle material will be just slightly out of alignment. It might be a flaw in my drill press, or my drill bits are dull, and so or even just the vise holding the handle material, or even the table it's resting on. Somewhere in there, it's not perfectly up and down. So when I drill a hole, and then which is the slot for the tang to slide in, the handle is usually canted off one way or the other. So after I try to start with blocks large enough to have room for that, to account for that. And so when I do the final glue up, and the first thing afterwards is centering the handle up to the blade. Again, I don't use anything super sophisticated. I am developing a jig for that, but right now I have a little like 6-inch metal ruler that's maybe half an inch wide or a centimeter wide, and I just sight down the spine and mark out a couple spots and use that ruler to kind of extend that line to find the center line along the spine, and then I do that along the belly too with the cutting edge. I don't usually use the ruler on the cutting edge. I'll just eyeball down the cutting edge, the center line down the belly side of the handle. And then from there, I use my calipers to measure the difference. Usually, one side or the other of the handle block is closer to that center line. And so whichever is the narrowest, I'll use that as the measurement for the other side, and I'll mark off the difference. And then I just put it up to the grinder and cut away the excess material. And then my handle is centered up to the blade. And then from there, I just start grinding evenly. But again, cool. It's just all by eye.
Yeah. Okay.
One easy,
oh, goodness,
easy there.
Bless your soul.
Bless your soul. I try to think everything like forging, and when you learn how to forge, if you're trying to go make a square bar into a round bar, it's every step, and you make everything square. So you make the square, you make the bar square, and then all you do is focus on that one step, which is make it square. Then you break the corners. Mm-hmm. Then you break the corners, you make an octagon. Then you break those corners, and then you break those corners. I do the same thing when I'm finishing up the handles. I make everything square, then I break the corners. Then I break those corners. And then I'm constantly just like trying to do one step at a time.
Sure.
I also use the disc grinder a lot. Especially, once you have your sizing for a full tang knife or hidden tang knife, and you have your marks up, the disc grinder is so helpful when it comes to getting things, helping you round things. You can roll things over on it, and then you can pull. If you get off of your broad back, you can push the platen out, and you can kind of do similar things. I think it's so important to just be very mindful of your steps. And I do have a trick that I started to think about and really talk about. A lot of guys have a lot of problems with the underside of their knives, the underside of the belly, especially if you have like a pistol grip or you have not like a lot of contouring, but like a pistol grip style. If you take the platen off your 2x72 grinder and you have a belt that's on the thicker side, like 80 grit or something like that, something with a type of belt that's got a lot of thickness to it. You can, everything's very tight, you can really use that belt to kind of clean up on the slack, to clean up the underside of the belly, which I know it can be difficult. I see a lot of people trying to clean up the underside of their knives with a Dremel, and I find Dremels to be problematic just because I think a lot of people have a hard time feathering in the Dremel lines. But if you really use the slack belt wisely, you can get into so many places underside that you wouldn't think that you could.
Are you talking about the profile of the handle?
Talking about, the profile of the handle.
On the belly?
Right, the profile of the handle. Okay. If you have like a contoured, like let's say like my Bull Elk knives have like a pistol grip and the underside's hard, if you have the goddamn platen on, you get it chippy, it won't be smooth.
Yeah.
But if I put on a 36 grit belt or 80 grit belt and then I have it really tight, I can, it's tight enough that it holds itself together and it's not conforming, but it's also kind of taking all the high spots off evenly and gently. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. There you go. There you go. Knife tip.
There you go. That's what we're here for. Oh, yeah.
Yes, that and fist dip. Knife tip and fist dip.
There's a title. Oh, boy. Knife tips and fist dips.
Oh, no. Or fish sticks. We used to call, I remember Twiglets. When I was a kid, we would have, we would have for lunch at the school, we'd have fish sticks. But the lunch lady, when she set them fast, we thought she said, would you like some fish dicks? So we always called them fish dicks. So for years, I thought, you know,
they were fish
fucking
sticks.
Big old fish dick.
There you go. Perfect. Who's taking the next one?
This one is from... Oh, shit. Oh, Jesus. What the fuck happened? There we go. Forge Allard. It says, hello, I'm Dicks Inside of the Forge Allard. I'd like to know if you guys let some extra material... Or, sorry. I'd like to know if you guys leave, probably, is what it's supposed to say. Leave some extra material on the edge if you get laser cut. If you get laser cut blanks, so I won't mess up the heat treat. Thanks for the great show, and always, as always, fun listening to you guys. So, when using lasers, frickin' lasers to cut out blades, what do you suggest? Leave account for a little bit of extra material along the edge, or just take it straight up to the edge?
Take it, if it's a laser, personally, with my designs, I have them take them right up to the edge. Okay. If it's plasma... they can be a little bit dirtier if it's not looked after so well. It's a lot more difficult to get a clean cut on a plasma.
Right.
So maybe I'd think then that you need to give yourself a bit of meat left. But with a laser, I've never had any issues at all, and they're bang. Even to the point where I'm doing sort of 3 millimeter holes, a laser will cut them perfectly to 3 millimeters as well.
Right.
They'll pierce straight through. So yeah, personally, I don't think it's an issue with a laser. Or a water jet, for that matter.
I've gotten nervous because people are wondering what you're talking about. If you get your knives, you go to Knife Print, you get your knives designed up, and then you get them printed out, and then they'll water jet cut them. They'll be like a line. It'll be like a slightly jagged line, almost like a It's like a jagged line.
It's like the kerf of a saw, but it's water, right?
Yeah, right, right. So
water and or like an abrasive.
Right. So you it's not like a smooth edge.
Right.
I have noticed at one time I heat treated one without doing anything, and one of the little fissure, it turned into a fissure that turned into the beginnings of a crack.
Mm.
So I am conscious of cleaning the profiles up before I heat treat.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
And then getting rid of as much as, I don't go overboard, but like I just kind of make them clean. And I don't.
Yeah. Oh, I'd Scotch-Brite all the edges, yeah.
Because what I don't want is I've seen it and I don't want it. So I don't want to have to. And the other thing is like the most you can clean up before, especially if you're using something like 440C or something that's very wear resistant, why would you want, if you can do it beforehand or at least take off some of the mess. When it's easier, why not do it?
Right.
But I do take off a little bit. I don't account for it in the it's so minuscule that I don't account for it. But I get everything water jet cut, so I don't have that problem. I don't know what you're talking about. I know that some people plasma cut out their knives, and I get concerned because I wonder how hot that plasma will make that edge. I've been told that it's not enough to harden it. But at the same time, it's like if you're doing it on your own and the parts of, you know, plasma cutters, it's not like you buy it and it's great. There are parts called consumables. And if you don't replace a lot of the consumable parts, they're going to give you a bad cut. And they're going to give you like, it's not going to be an exact cut. You're going to have like a little bit of it's like a fucked up oxyacetylene torch.
Sure.
So like I would be concerned about that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they'll always need a clean up, even with laser and water jet. And I'd say, even let's say in sort of the handle, let's say you've your pinholes have been cut or some weight relief cut or skeletonized or whatever it may be. When you're doing the design, you quite often want to put your lead in into a hole. So the lead-in is basically where the laser or the water jet will start. So it doesn't start exactly on the line. It'll start slightly off, then move its way in. So obviously for a hole, your lead-in is within that hole because that's being cut out. Mm-hmm. But it'll sometimes leave a slight sort of mushroom.
Slag, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah. And it's a very slight mushroom. So I always clean everything up anyway once it's been cut, just to make sure you get rid of those. And they can be minuscule, but obviously if you're putting handles on them, for a full tang knife, for example, that needs to be completely flat. So it's always worth to clean it, and it takes a second. A Scotch-Brite belt is all, you're not really taking material away as such, just taking away any sort of extras that you do want there. For those who have never done anything like this before, a really good way to get into this is with knifeprint.com, because it's all done in the browser. It's CAD, but done in a browser. You don't need to download any programs at all. They've got a really good education center there, which they'll show you how to do that. I mean, you'll be able to design knives and save them and make edits and so on, but you'll be able to see it in 3D and swing it around and see exactly how it'll look. But they've then got a print button, and as Jeff said, they'll either laser jet or water jet cut it out. You pick the steel that you want, and you'll get it in the post. These blanks are perfectly ready to go. If it's something you've never toyed with before, just go and have a play. Knifeprint.com. And if nothing else, you'll learn a lot.
I have emergency feedback about a knife print. This comes from Legacy Blades. He says, you guys have been talking a lot about knife print, and I just want to echo the excellent instructions Dennis Terrell has provided in his YouTube tutorial. I have no experience with CAD, so having someone walk you through the widgets was super helpful. Thanks for continuing to bring a great resource to light, Jared.
Nice.
Good enough for Jared. It's good enough for you. Dennis Terrell doing nice videos for knife print.
Can I add a little bit more to that last question?
Go ahead.
Sure, yes.
And so it sounds like the big concern is like what is happening to the material along the edge? And it sounds like, because both of you guys have had work cut one way or another, that maybe 10 to 20 thousandths is being taken off the edge anyways for just regular cleanup, which is what, 25 to 50 or 0.25 to 0.50 millimeter. Anyways, just a normal cleanup and grinding and whatnot. I think it is also important to keep in mind that if you're heat treating in an ambient environment, like without any foil or anything like that, whether it's in a forge or in a kiln, that is also something you want to take into consideration, is that you are going to want to remove just the slightest bit of material from the edge too, because the edge, the material closest to the outside of the cross-section of the blade is going to become decarburized through the heat treating process, and you are going to want to get rid of that before you do put your final edge on. So in all of those situations, It sounds like we definitely want to pull off just a little bit off the edge before we put our final edge on and call it good.
You know what? It's interesting because I've seen a number of really top-level knife makers who, when they get their knives water jet cut or the blanks created, mm-hmm. they'll put a little tab on the tip. I think Don does it, and there's some other guys. They'll make sure that in the design there's a tab on the tip, and it's like an extra little square that sticks off the tip of the knife of material.
Right.
And it's so you don't grind your tip off when you're grinding them down.
Or to overheat it, because it's so small down out there, like the thermal mass isn't there, and it's so easy to overheat. So having that extra material there helps keep it from overheating so easily.
Yeah. And then you just nip it off at the end.
Yeah, and then at the end you just clean it right off.
It's a pretty strong move.
It's a strong move.
Yeah, very nice. Okay. I think it's now also time to tell everybody about Dharma Steel then as well. Stainless Damascus, some of the most beautiful patterns you could ever hope to imagine to see on dharmasteel.se. They've got them all listed there, all their patterns. Super, super easy to work with. And again, they've got a great education center there showing you how to heat treat and how to etch and all the rest of it. Really, really good people. Go to Dharma Steel Lab or Dharma Steel AB on Instagram. And you'll see the kind of stuff people are using Dharma Steel for. Really sort of high-end stuff. Super clean Damascus. It's just really, really, really top-level stuff. So go take a look. DharmaSteel.se.
And when's the Dharma Steel Invitational?
November. So we need to start talking about the knives that we're making for that, because I've started down the way, and I think I don't know whether you guys have as well, but certainly some of our listeners would have. So we're coming close to that time when people start sort of sharing their designs for the Dharma Steel build along. It's going to be interesting to see. I'm looking forward to it. And it's always a good show as well. The show that they put on, the Chef Invitational, it's always good fun.
It's one of our highlight shows of the year.
It is. Absolutely. It really is, yeah.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I got to fucking get out of here soon. So maybe we should after show it and dip it off.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Okay. Well, everybody, thank you for listening. Jeff has rescued us here because my nuts are about to sweat.
So he's going to put that up yours, children.
And with that, we shall see you next week.
Yeah.
Okay, I keep seeing these advertisements for these fans you clip onto your belt loop and it shoots air up your shirt. So you just need one down at the end of your shorts to shoot up the pant of your leg. Yes.
What is
it? It's
this?
A tiny little fan that you carry around on your hip.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how effective it is, but no. I could imagine sitting there in the hot, soupy warmth that the fan would be pretty nice shooting up the panty leg.
Yeah.
Or leg. Wow,
pant. Yeah.
Nice. Up the old leg.
Up the old leg.
I tell you what Southern California has that is beat the Northeast breaks off. Fucking taco trucks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. My kid and I, the first night we were there, we were walking to a Ralph's just to get something because we thought that the hurricane was going to be serious. So we was like, there's a Ralph's down the street, which is like a convenience store. And there was a taco truck right next to it. And I said, hey, Lila, if we don't find anything in that place, we're going to hit some tacos. I said, we got it. That's what they're known for. LA is known for this fucking taco truck.
Oh, yeah.
So we go into the Ralph's. It's a bunch of drug addicts. There's a lot of drug addicts in there. And every time I see one, I think it's a drug addict. I turn around. I'm like, these are your people now. I've been fucking killing her. That's been, she's like, God, Dad.
Lube masters and drug addicts.
This is your play. These are your people now. Oh, it's hilarious. So then we went over the taco truck and it was like a truck. And then they had a little table and you'd order the tacos, and that all it would be a tortilla, corn tortilla, tiny corn tortillas, like a two biter. And then there would be a little tray, and they have different sauces and a little radish and a little onion and a little lime and a little cilantro. God, and we sat on the side of the road and ate these fucking tacos. And we're like, the tacos in LA, even the street ones got New York beat by a mile. Can't get much better than them.
I've been following a spot based out of LA. What is it? It's Tacos El Venado. They have like almost 200,000 followers. They're in North Hollywood, California, and it's torture looking at their page and like seeing their posts every once in a while because it just looks so fucking incredible.
The school did an event just for the parents to no kids. The parents were there. It was like, you know, you've got tons of kids, tons of parents. I mean, they had beer and wine, and then they had a taco bar.
Nice.
And the fucking tacos from the school were unbelievable. Like I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. So that's awesome. Well, maybe if you get down there again, you can try to hit up Will Brigham, although that's extra. When you're going into LA to visit your kid, you're probably just there for the kid.
There was a lot of like, you know, Andres Kalani reached out and I had a lot of nice messages from Josh Scott, who's not, farther down, but he was just super cool in terms of like, you ever need anything. And then Fell Knives, and there's a lot of cool knife makers over there. Nick sent a nice message to me, and you know, if you ever want to get together or you never need anything. And a lot of people were just like, you know, well, the cool thing is the knife community, who most of these people I've never even met, said if she's ever in a jam or you need something, you know, let me know. And that was really, really cool. And that was a really, really cool thing to do. And I would never ask, but it was a very nice gesture on a lot of people that I've never met before's situation. So many thanks.
Yeah, very nice. Well, I'm just looking at these tacos that Mareko has just sent. Taco Sel Venado. Wow. Yeah, they look incredible. They look really good. Oh, but see what we were talking about last week about American food just being bulk and filth. There's no finesse there at all, but it looks amazing.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's not about the finesse.
Oh, my wife and daughter, when they went out there last year, there's a place called Grand Central Market in downtown LA. And it's this huge space where there's just tons of different foods and Filipino food and in Mexican food and Thai food. And it was like stalls, like a street, like almost like a small city, like a Mexico City type, you know, street vendor place.
Yeah.
We ate the fuck out of that shit. And they had this one guy called the Donut Man who made donuts, and they cut them open and put fresh peaches in the donuts. And it was like mind blowing fried chicken and all these Korean fried chicken and tacos and burritos and all this fucking awesome shit. I was like, it was the food scene there is fucking great.
Nice. I just found those peach filled donuts. Those look crazy.
It's seasonal too, because like most of the year it's fresh strawberry filled donuts.
I got you.
And then now they have the peach ones, and they were not too. It was just the food was awesome. The food in LA was awesome. Mm.
So. It's a good food town for sure. All right, guys, what do you think?
Yes, let's get out of here.
You gotta cool off.
yeah.
All right, gents.
Right. Thank you all for listening, and we should speak to you again next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.